So right now, sounds like things could change fairly soon, but for the moment, I guess it seems pretty clear that in terms of first-line therapy, people are choosing alectinib. What about second-line therapy after alectinib, but also second-line therapy after crizotinib? What are the options in terms of approved agents, and what do we know in terms of data?
So I'll start with the post-crizotinib setting first, and then we'll go to the post-alectinib setting. So post-crizotinib, investigators have multiple options right now. In terms of approved options, the three FDA-approved therapies in the United States are ceritinib, brigatinib, and alectinib. I would say that, you know, all of these drugs have shown high response rates post-crizotinib. Brigatinib has shown a bit longer of a progression-free survival, but again, these are cross-trial comparisons. Each drug has a slightly different toxicity profile, and I think that is taken into account as well. I think among these three drugs, ceritinib has a lot of GI toxicities, and it can be a challenging drug, even with necessary dose reductions. They have tried exploring alternative dosing, including dosing with food. This is the ASCEND-8 study where the FDA label had been with dosing 750 milligrams in a fasting state. And ASCEND-8 looked at lower dosing schedules with the addition of food based on some studies that had been done showing that there was a food effect and that you could actually boost the exposure of the drug by taking it with food and actually decrease the GI toxicities. And that's indeed what they observed. But I still think that ceritinib can be a challenging drug. And in general, many clinicians have been discouraged from using it when they have several other good alternatives. And so, you know, alectinib versus brigatinib, one key distinguishing toxicity that clinicians should be mindful of with brigatinib, there's this frequency of respiratory events. So they tend to occur early. So the frequency is about 6% of patients, with a median time to onset of about 2 days. And it can be coughing, it can be shortness of breath. But this has informed the dosing strategy where patients start with 90 milligrams for 7 days. And then if they don't develop any respiratory symptoms, then they dose escalate to 180 milligrams. So that's a toxicity that distinguishes brigatinib from the other ALK inhibitors. So I would say all three are regulatory approved agents. My practice has generally been to use alectinib or brigatinib in that setting. But we're seeing less and less of the post-crizotinib space right now. I think the more challenging question is, what do we do post-alectinib? And there, I think we're still trying to understand how do ALK-positive lung cancers develop resistance to alectinib. Some of the work that we've done at our institution trying to understand this on a molecular level, we've found that about 50% of patients who are receiving alectinib, and with the caveat here being that many of these patients had received crizotinib first, so we don't know what this is going to look like with first-line alectinib, but about 50% of patients will develop an additional ALK resistance mutation. And unlike in the EGFR space, it's not just one mutation. There can be multiple different ALK resistance mutations, but it does look like one in particular is just more frequent compared to the others, and it's a solvent front mutation called ALK G1202R. And so we've done some work both in the lab and in the clinic showing that while the presence of ALK resistance mutations don't seem to matter much post-crizotinib, post these second generation ALK inhibitors, they actually do matter more. And for me, clinically, presence of an ALK resistance mutation would direct me more towards pursuing an agent like lorlatinib. Now, it's not FDA approved yet. It has breakthrough therapy status, but there is an expanded access program, and that's what I would typically pursue in a patient with one of these ALK resistance mutations.